Now I thought flying saucers were only a myth, that people from other planets didn't exist. But since they have landed here from outer space, there's cups hunting saucers all over the blaze. Yeah. Now Iper Khan and Kipper Ching, they journey down to Earth to do some visiting. And the dance they did was the funniest thing, for as they danced together, every one of them would sing. The Amanda of a me of my Amanda, and a me of my Amanda, she a take a my Amanda. We a kibble cobble too, we a kibble cobble fro, and though the music's speedy, never let her hand go. Chongo, chango, husky, chesty fellies, take the hand of their slender villanellies, each one a singing as they twirl and whirl. Kibble dee, cobble dee, wind up and swirl. Come all ye cups, each grab your galley, oh, and spin her around and round. Don't let her down before you toss her into the nearest whirling, twirling, flying saucer. This ends the bibble bobble dance of kibble cobble. Chongo, chango, husky, chesty fellies, take the hand of their slender villanellies, each one a singing as they twirl and whirl. Kibble dee, cobble dee, wind up and swirl. Come all ye cups, each grab your galley, oh, and spin her around and round. Don't let her down before you toss her into the nearest whirling, twirling, flying saucer. This ends a bibble bobble dance of kibble cobble. This ends a bibble bobble dance of kibble cobble.
That's usually called dead air, and that's a big no-no. It's Radio Misterioso, and there's guests in the studio today, which has not been a rare thing recently. Hey, that's why they did that. Hey, there was a reason that I can't reach the microphone, because it's broken. Radio Misterioso here, Sundays 8 to 10 p.m. Today we have two guests, and you're going to want to sit down and record this and then spread it all over the internet. Paul Kimball and Mac, how do you pronounce your last name? There we go. Are your mics on?
I don't know. Mine is. Hello. Well, they're fixing the microphones right now, so
there we go.
I'm talking. There's a third guest here as well. He's Rear Admiral Zorgrod, an alien explorer from a distant planet.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
There you go. We're all little quackers tonight. Yeah.
What have you? Wait. Let me. You know what? Let me introduce you first. A lot of people, unless they're kind of UFO nuts or ufologists, or, well, what's the difference, probably know about Mac and Paul through their websites and their commentaries on their websites. So probably most ufologists have heard of them, but I would say that the rank and file probably disagree with them on most points, which is why I want to have them on the show and why I like them. You don't get on many... I would really like to face you when I do this one. I'm afraid I'm going to... Yeah, see? There we go.
There we are.
You don't really get... You two don't really get interviewed or put in documentaries or anything like that, although the stuff that you say, I think, is very relevant, and you bring a degree of skepticism and a new kind of... not new, but a needed and new, yeah. Viewpoint, and I think that's why you probably don't get the kind of coverage that I think you deserve. But maybe if I do introductions, I'm going to screw them up, and I've introduced as much as I can, so why doesn't somebody punch the other guy and hold him down and go first and introduce yourself?
All right, I'll go first. I'm Paul Kimball from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. I'm a documentary filmmaker, or more than just documentaries. Not all UFOs. I've done stuff on classical music, pro wrestling, all sorts of stuff. But I've made three UFO docs, and I've got two more that I'm working on now, one of which we interviewed Greg
yes.
about a month ago up in Halifax for on cattle mutilations.
And you come down here, and you get the exact same weather.
Yeah, exactly, which it's perfect. Well, we were in Dallas before we got here, so 100 degrees. I'm happy to be in L.A.
Oh, okay.
And I have my own blog. I'm not a ufologist, but I do some ufological research. There is a difference between being a UFO researcher and a ufologist.
Yeah.
www.redstarfilms.blogspot.com.
Right.
And that's me.
And I am Mac Tonies. I am an author slash blogger from the Midwest, specifically Kansas City. And I've been writing about Mars for a while, basically just kind of a running commentary on the whole controversy regarding certain anomalous surface formations that don't seem to have been addressed fairly by the mainstream scientific community, in my own personal opinion. I have a book called After the Martian Apocalypse, which I kind of like. It came out in 2004, and I'm working on a new one now on a little more closer to home approach to exit. There we go. All right. Done with the hunch. I do plenty of hunching anyway over the computer.
Yeah.
But the new one is more close to home. It's dealing with...
Make noise, it's okay.
Dealing with the idea that some aliens are actually not aliens at all. And so it's kind of an interesting idea to play with. So
or at least in the classical sense where people think
yeah,
of
exactly.
bug eyes from another planet.
Quite,
and we will talk about that. So when I did the introduction, I said that, Paul... you haven't written a book really yet or anything like that, but you've gotten famous through your site. And then I found out that you're speaking in England at which conference?
It's a conference in Manchester. Stuart Miller of UFO Review is putting it on
okay.
on June 10th with Nick Redfern speaking. I'm speaking.
That's good. Nick's from Manchester,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And two other guys that I can't remember what their names are. And it's, yeah, it should be fun. I've done one or two conferences before. They're always fun. I don't write books. I make films, so I work in a different kind,
oh, okay.
of, different kind of medium. But I'd like to write a book someday.
I think you should. There was a woman at the National UFO Conference here running around behind the organizer all day saying, why can't I get to talk here? Why don't I get to talk here? I have stuff to say. Why can't I talk?
Well... maybe because you're nuts. Not to put too fine a point on it.
And then
but.
She'd ask questions during the lectures and say, you know, I think I should be allowed to talk. You know, I don't know why I'm not getting... It's like...
Well, to be fair, I go mainstream on Tuesday night. I'm doing 3 hours with George and Ori on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, so how the hell did you get on there without a book?
I have no idea.
Who recommended? Somebody probably just saw your site and said there's something here we need to put out there.
Actually, you know, to be perfectly honest, I sent them an email. Stan Friedman told me, said, yeah, you should send an email. I did Nori once 2 years ago. When I was speaking at the Crash Retrieval Conference.
Oh, that's right. I called during that, too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Was that you?
I think so. I called. I said, I'm calling from inside the hotel.
Oh, wait a second. That did. Yeah, I do sort of vaguely recall that.
Linda Howe was on. At the
yeah,
same
yeah, she
time.
Was doing the interview, was basically, and then she was answering the questions as well as asking them. So I'm kind of hoping that this time I'll actually get to say a few things.
Yeah, well, if you're the only guest, maybe you'll be okay unless somebody calls in and they let them take over, like Dodie did, but that was okay.
Yeah.
yeah, and on the website it actually says Paul Kimball, renowned ufologist. Not renowned.
Renown.
Yeah.
Well, that's Stuart.
Renown.
Yeah, that's Stuart Miller, so I didn't write that. He
oh,
did.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
It is kind of, I think it says renowned filmmaker, not renowned ufologist.
Oh, okay.
Which I'm sure everybody here in Hollywood would chuckle at if they saw that.
Yeah, well, people in Manchester aren't going to know.
No. Yeah.
They figure that somewhere else is the center of the universe, and if they say, if Stuart says renowned, then you're renowned.
Absolutely, yeah. Or renowned, yes.
Yeah, renowned. Mac, why did you want to get... Well, you're involved in so many things. I looked at your website. I've looked at it a few times.
It's a little eclectic.
Yeah. What attracts you to the UFO subject, being the futurist and cyberpunk?
Yeah, I know. I've got these kind of crisscrossing literary futurist UFO... memes going through my head, and I like UFOs are appealing to me on so many different levels. I like the whole, first and foremost, I like the whole idea of others in our midst in some capacity, whether they're extraterrestrials or something else. But I also like the cultural ramifications of that.
Yeah.
And it's such a weird, gnarly field to get into. It's difficult to articulate. I just have this fascination.
Articulate. We have 2 hours to articulate and look at how much I've written. That much. So we can expand quite a bit on what I've written. I just thought this stuff up today while I was.
I guess the basic impetus behind my interest in UFOs and ufology is simply a fascination with the idea of the other. You know, just this of the alien, the archetype, whatever that means. Like The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie's one of my favorite movies, and it has very little bearing on UFOs, but nevertheless, that existential appeal, I don't know.
I thought you were talking about my mistress there for a second when you said the other.
It's
good to see you're only looking into crypto-terrestrials yet.
That's a word people haven't heard, crypto-terrestrials. I hadn't heard it until I read it on your site.
It seems to be synonymous with me. I'd Googled it, actually, and I'm the only person so far. I didn't coin the term. Someone going by the handle Mr. X, spelled E-C-K-S, actually coined the term and reminded me of that, fortunately. Otherwise, I probably would have gone on to take credit for coining it.
Each time you say it, you have to say copyright Mr.
Copyright Mr. X.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe Mr. X can call in. I'll give the number out later. We often get calls once every geologic period. Paul called once.
I called in once. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, just say something. Yeah.
I was going to go back and forth, but now that Mac is talking, I looked at your site and there's, I think, there's probably like 100 book reviews there of all kinds of different things, and including a lot of stuff I'm interested in, and including a review of my book. I said, you ripped me a
Bring
new one
on.
In your review. You said that I had a scattershot approach.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Can you expand on that so I can take a swing at you, or at least explain what I was doing?
Sure.
Because, you know what, I kind of agree with you, but I know why that happened.
Well, my book has a scattershot approach, too. You could level the same criticism at After the Martian Apocalypse very easily.
Well, then that's Patrick's fault.
Fault. Yeah. We have a common enemy. No, actually, I liked your book a lot, and Paul mentioned that it was something like, I don't know, one of the most important UFO books of the year or more.
Zorgi Award winning, anyway.
And I agreed with them, and I get the book.
Thank you.
It was. I don't want to come across as like. Oh, I just wish it could have been more.
I don't mind. If you're going to say something nasty, go right ahead.
No, I'm going to say something flattering. I want it to sound like I'm trying to suck up. But it was one of those books.
No need to. I don't have any money or anything.
For years, I've been reading about the whole Benowitz affair. It's always a real peripheral treatment. And I've always wanted to learn more about that. And I finally get the book that details it in considerable detail, and I was fascinated by it, and I guess I just kind of wanted more.
The weird thing was? The linchpin of the whole thing was that Paul Benowitz was, one, dead.
Right.
3 weeks before I came out to Albuquerque. 2 weeks. I think it was a week before I came out to Albuquerque to start the book. Number two, his family would have never let me talk to him anyway. And number three, he was too old and out of it and sick to be able to talk to me. And the only people I could talk to about what was going on with Paul on a day-to-day basis, nobody knew that. Only his family did, because he was kind of a geeky scientist guy.
Right. Yeah.
And he had his company and he had his UFO interest and a couple other, you know, personal ones that I didn't really get into, you know, like playing the guitar, and he was a pilot, and I think he read Wild West novels or something.
Yeah,
nobody could explain to me what kind of person he was and where he was coming from and what his motivation was. I had to kind of glean that from what ufologists told me. And, of course, all they talked to him about was the UFO stuff.
Those UFOs, yes.
So it was a little difficult in that way.
Schematic.
Yeah, there's more character exposition on Bill Moore and Richard Doty than there is on the main subject of the book.
And that was
because
cool,
I couldn't get to it. And plus, it was the first one, and the writing wasn't that great. But I'm glad you enjoyed it.
No,
I don't think it's a book about Paul Benowitz. I mean, he's the focal point.
Yeah, it's a spy story.
Yeah, and he just happens to be the guy around which all the action seems to revolve. But there's so many other things going on, and I think that's why so many ufologists maybe didn't read the book because most of the ones I talked to said, I didn't really like it, and they'll say, well, we didn't really read it either.
I've seen reviews where they said I didn't put things in that are in there multiple times.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, did you even read the book? Why are you criticizing me for something that I didn't do that I did?
The truth is, it contains uncomfortable facts that a lot of ufologists, especially the ones in operation in the 80s, when MJ-12 and cattle mutilations and everything seemed to be coming, and Roswell coming to a head, they just don't want to confront. And Nick Redfern, I don't agree with Nick's thesis in Body Snatchers in the Desert, but he ran into the same thing when he released that book, and he's starting to run into the same thing with, although much less, with his new book, Saucer Spies.
Really? I really can't think. That seems so harmless to me. You would think that ufologists would want to know who was being watched and why and the history of that.
People still, I think, are fascinated and don't want to let go of the prospect, even the faintest sliver of possibility that the whole MJ-12 mythos has some grain of extraterrestrial truth there. I think that's a problem for some people, letting go of that.
I think it might have a grain, but then my opinion changes from the next thing I read, and I see Bill all the time, and he steadfastly says, I had nothing to do, it was handed to me, and I have no choice but to believe him because I can't think of anything else. I haven't found any evidence to the contrary, and I tried to get him in today, but apparently his daughter's having a baby this weekend, so he's going to be a grandpa, like, for the third time. I've never caught him saying anything to me that I later found out to be untrue, and he's told me a lot of shit, so I have a hard time, like, because he won't talk to anybody, so I have to kind of once in a while be the mouthpiece, and I feel like people are leveling stuff at me but it just shows that the UFO field, like any field actually, any endeavor, political, scientific, anything, is run by people's opinions and their beliefs and their thoughts, and then everything else, all the proof is subservient to that, it seems like, in most cases.
It's a belief system. Almost, you can address it like that, and that's the easiest way to address it.
The shame is that
I'm not singling out ufology.
No,
I'm
no.
just saying it's you know,
it's not.
And
unique.
You two are like one of the few that don't actually act that way.
the shame of it is there's so much good stuff out there. As I found out over the years, but doing a film on the top 10 UFO cases.
I was going to ask you about that.
You see, there they are. Those are 10 top-notch UFO cases, as Dick Hall says, 10 of the best. Because there's really, 50 that I could have picked from.
Right.
The skeptics have tried to demolish these cases. I shouldn't use the word. Mac and I were talking about skeptics, and that's, ufology uses that as a pejorative term, and frankly, shouldn't.
It should be separated between skeptic and debunker, but.
Yeah, and even debunking
even
is good.
Debunker can be.
If it's bunk.
It has to be bunk.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of the anti-believers, if you will, the people who sit on the other side of that sort of philosophical fence. But anyway, there's all these great cases. And when you sit down, as Finley, my director of photography, is here taking pictures, and I did a few days ago, talked to a former senior officer in the Air Force who flew top-secret planes, an extremely credible guy, and he says, look, we had a case, and we came down, and they said to us, you saw nothing. It was the old Schultz thing. You saw nothing. Nothing happened. Don't talk about this.
Right.
And then it just goes away. And I asked him, I said, well, did you guys talk amongst yourselves with other crews who might have had similar sightings? He said, the easiest way to get posted to Alaska or to get drummed out of the Air Force, I paraphrase here, but basically to watch your career come to a stop was to talk about these things.
And being told not to?
Yeah. And they'll talk. So, is the government covering something up? Of course they were. But the question is, for what reason and to what extent
exactly.
And who was doing it?
That was one of my questions.
And that's where I disagree.
For you too.
Yeah, that's where I disagree with the MJ-12 people and all these cosmic Watergate types like Stan Friedman. They think they're covering it up because of alien technology, and I think they're covering it up because they're afraid to admit that they don't know what UFOs are.
I wrote down a quote somewhere here from John Keel in one of his books. It was kind of tongue in cheek, but it makes sense. And he said he went through an argument, and his conclusion was the UFO research community is not telling the government what it knows about UFOs. Because maybe Matt can field this question too. I mean.
Okay.
What do they know? And if they if the I don't know. I mean, you can't really look at the government as this monumental thing.
That's a problem I ran into with the whole with the Mars research. If people would ask me questions like, "Well, is NASA covering up evidence of intelligently designed structures on Mars?" You know, that's the common X-Files interpretation of NASA's cover up.
Richard Hoagland.
He's helped that along immensely, and I'm very skeptical of that. I don't think there is a big, huge monolithic cover up. I think it is simply a problem of an intellectual problem, a failure to communicate, a failure of ideas between NASA's different research centers, which are not. You think of NASA as this agency where everyone is smiling and working for the common good.
Yeah, it's not Disney.
No, it's not Disney. It's schizophrenic. You've got all these different like JPL, which is in charge of the deep space missions. Totally opposed to Johnson Space Flight Center, because if Johnson Space Flight Center got the Mars budget, that'd be manned missions.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with lots of money and lots of power.
Power struggles.
And let's say we did have some very tantalizing evidence, and I think we do, that there are very unusual features on Mars that deserve further investigation. I'm not saying they're necessarily artificial.
Yeah.
But if Johnson Space Flight Center were to get the Mars budget, if we were to discover that and make that quite public, which is something only JPL could do right now, then the money goes to Johnson Space Flight Center because that makes a manned mission look a lot more attractive.
Yeah. Well, delving into your book, what kind of stuff do you talk about in the book in regards to something that may not look natural? And mm-hmm. I guess we'll disregard the face thing because that picture
sure.
that came out from the global surveyor is a lot clearer.
Yeah, and
unless you think that's a cover up too, but you know we won't.
No, it's not a cover up. It's an actual picture, and they've taken it multiple times from different angles and different slightly different sun angles and altitudes. From different spacecraft, and it definitely looks interesting to me, and certainly less space-like than the very iconic, simplistic-looking image that we saw from the Viking probes. But
I think it looks interesting.
I think it's still not just a
simulacra.
I don't think so personally. If we saw something like that in the desert of Iran or something
via
satellite,
yeah.
we'd send our archaeologists to check it out.
It has
amazing symmetry.
Right.
You can plot this thing. It's non-fractal. I mean, you can run computer programs. It looks odd to the human eye, but it also looks odd to computer programs that are not predisposed to seeing faces. So
right.
no matter what it is, it's odd. It qualifies
mm-hmm.
as an anomaly, I think, by
yeah.
any reasonable
right.
person would concede that, but except, of course, NASA. But it's not just the face. We've got all kinds of interesting...
Yeah, please go on.
Yeah, we have some interesting pyramidal formations that, you know, the whole pyramids on Mars...
Oh, the Cydonia Plain pyramid.
Well, there's some in Cydonia, but as we get better and better pictures... I was in New Mexico early this year? Well, not too long ago, filming a documentary for the Discovery Channel. And I was cut out. You know, it turned out to be a very believer versus the debunkers. You know,
yeah, very, and you don't fit
typical.
In either.
And I was debating. You know, why didn't they make it? You know, they flew me out of the hill. They spent a whole day of their time filming me, and you know,
I have experienced this.
Yeah, and
at least the
questions they're asking me were very leading. You know, like, so what about this NASA cover up? You know, and I was trying to explain. Well, you know, I don't think it's really. I don't think they're sitting on a vault of proof. You know, like in the Indiana Jones movie where they card off the evidence at the end. So it could be that I'm just a little too much in the gray, and it's not easy to. I must have had fun trying to edit that, if they even tried.
Uh-huh.
And that might not be the reason. Maybe I was just inarticulate.
But you did. You're being articulate now. But you, I wanted to get you to describe some, you know, other things. Oh well, you did. You said
well,
like pyramidal structures.
Well, pyramidal structure, and there's this other feature that's
those wormhole-looking things.
No.
Or the ones that look like tubes?
The ones that look like tubes, I think, are natural formations.
Because there's lava tubes.
Right.
Here.
I addressed that in the book because it's an interesting controversy. And, I mean, of course, you can't prove a negative, you know. And some people are going to maintain that these are, well, they're just severely degraded. You know, they used to look much better. They used to look better. And
their godlike eye, they know this.
But. Right, exactly. And, I think they're definitely, we see them everywhere, different versions of these on Mars. They're all over the surface and they're very interesting, but I don't think they're, it's like spaghetti. If we're looking at urban planning, then it's horrible urban planning. And I can't I can't outthink alien engineers and what they might come up with in terms of mass transit or water distribution whatever. But I think it basically sparked the whole idea of Percival Lowell's canals, you know, girdling the planet, bringing water to everything. And it seemed to revive that in kind of a high-tech context.
They right,
these
exactly.
These tubes, these interesting glass tubes with these ribbed support structures and everything. And some of the photos are very suggestive, but when you take a close look at them and run them through shape-by-shading algorithms, they turn out some of them aren't even tubes. They're actually opposite. They're depressions in the ground.
Okay.
So
it's optical illusion.
It's in fact sometimes it's just as simple as getting a picture of one of these things and turning it, and the direction that you're looking at it, and I sound like a classic Face on Mars debunker. Well, it's just the way you look at it. I don't want to come across like that, but no, I'm personally convinced that these are natural.
Yeah. Okay. Ignoring Paul, unfortunately, for a couple more minutes.
No. Keep going.
What in your book that you describe in your book intrigued you as something besides, like you said, the face which had uh-huh. some sign of sort of one, symmetry? What else is?
I'm interested in getting to the bottom of this, whether it's artificial or not. I really don't have any. I really don't care. I mean, some people won't believe that, and they accuse me. And say, you want to believe. You say you don't want to, but you really do.
Right.
And seriously, we're going to Mars. I'm excited about going to Mars, intelligent structures or not. How exciting can it get? I'd like to go myself. But there's a formation in the Cerberus region, actually several. One of them is a perfect square, and it's got a platform. And it's very much like the rectilinear platform that the Face Mesa is on, whether it's a construction or not. And so here we have kind of like a potential Rosetta Stone for deciphering what the face might be, because we can discern maybe whether or not there are natural processes that can reproduce a nice crisp rectangular form with very high degree of symmetry.
There's very surprising things on this planet that does that.
Yeah, and we have yet to see it on this planet. Like, we get these allusions to like Camelback Mountain in Arizona. You look at it, there's nothing like it. There's nothing symmetrical. It doesn't look like anything. It doesn't have any of the degree of anomaly that I think we see in many of the shots. And it's not. There's a study of these mound features in the Cydonia region, and that was done by Stan McDaniel, professor of philosophy at Sonoma State University, and theoretical physicist Horace Crater, and I forget where he works, but they're of the members of the Society for Planetary Study Research, and they did a statistical study of the distribution of these anomalous bright mounds in the Cydonia region. And they have a very compelling case that we're almost certainly seeing non-natural structures on Mars.
No, I'm surprised that hasn't gotten in the SSE journal yet because they've talked about it.
Yeah, it's very interesting because these features were originally identified not because they looked weird but because of their position.
Yeah.
They're simply bright, kind of reflective things. And but when you got high-resolution pictures, some of these are indeed very odd-looking. In fact, some of them are highly geometric. I mean, little...
Uh-huh.
kind of tetrahedral and square platforms and some of it's subtle, you know, so it doesn't leap out at you like, but you look at it and it's like, wait, this is very odd.
It's been hit by sandstorms for the last couple million years.
Yeah,
whatever,
the working assumption by some debunkers is that if we're seeing artificial ruins on Mars, then they should somehow be new, but that doesn't make any sense. To me, I mean, if we see eroded buildings here on Earth, you know, we accept that perhaps they were built by the culture a long time ago, and we're seeing something that's been abraded and, you know, been around for a long time.
Have you heard anything past, because a friend of mine went to a party about 10 years ago and met a former JPL scientist, and he'd written a book called...
The Living Planet? Mars Living Planet?
No, it wasn't about Mars, it was about the Moon.
Oh,
at the North Pole, near the lunar North Pole, uh-huh. there are these craters that are square.
Yeah, the square crater thing. I think some of that has been legitimately debunked.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, seriously. But it is very interesting when you look at it.
There's two of them.
Well, there's more than that. Double craters and that occur in like one next to the other. And it turns out that I think, and don't quote me on this, because I'm not an expert on the Moon, but I think from reading some work by Johnson Space Flight Center, Johnson Space Flight Center's Lan Fleming. He's a digital image worker there. I'm not exactly what the capacity he works in, but he does. He's contracted there, and he's done some really good work on that. And he has his website is vgl.org, and he's got some really good material there. And he's done some very interesting analyses of the face, suggesting that it is something more than a simulacra.
Okay, I'd like to see something on those square craters, though, because I haven't seen anything since.
He's got some on Sonus. He's got a moon section. And,
okay.
Yeah, it's well worth checking out.
All right, because people have been seeing structures on the moon like forever. I've got contactee literature from the 50s and saucer club type literature that talks about all the time with showing writing and everything on.
Yeah, right.
But out of all that, I thought these pictures from the, what was it, I can't remember which, it was one of the probes I sent to the moon to map it before the Apollo missions.
Right.
And Surveyor, I think.
Surveyor. The Surveyor, as it orbited, as it went around.
Surveyor 1 or 2 or 8 or whatever it
is. I lose track of the I'm pretty good on my Mars mission schedule, but the moon I get a little my sense of history gets a little jumbled.
Yeah. Actually, you know what, Paul, you mentioned a little while ago about Stan, and you sounded like you're almost a little bit, well, he's wacky in the area, but about MJ-12, but most people don't know that he's your uncle through marriage to your aunt.
Yeah, that's right.
those must be fun family reunions.
Yeah,
is everybody back up when you two get together?
No, actually, it's always very friendly. Stan and I agree on an awful lot of things. I have nothing but the greatest respect for Stan and the work he's done. But you know, he and I disagree about certain things too. Primarily, Stan looks at the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and he puts the emphasis on the ET part, and I look at the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and I put the emphasis on the hypothesis part.
Right.
It's a perfectly valid hypothesis, but I can list 5 or 6 others that are perfectly valid, too.
Right.
And he's made a leap based on the available evidence that I just can't make, and especially when you're dealing with something as controversial, as big, if you will, as this. So that's our fundamental point of disagreement, and out of that disagreement comes smaller disagreements about other things like the cosmic Watergate and the government cover-up. But yeah, right. The family reunions are always very amicable.
Sure.
He's hosting this year's. I'll be there in month and a half.
It was on your blog site.
Yeah.
You know, I did watch Stanton Friedman Is Real, the documentary you made.
Right.
And it seems like a roast, sort of, but it also seems like when you actually look, have you seen it, Mac?
Yeah, I haven't.
Oh,
when
you actually see what he does, what he goes through, what his life is like, it actually seems kind of not really that exciting.
It isn't. Stan would probably be the first person to tell you that life on the road, in fact, he says it in the film, life on the road is a drag. And I'll be the second person to tell you. I mean, here we are traveling across America, then we go to the UK, then Yukon, and people think, I run into people, say I went to law school with, and they go, wow, you live, you know, have this great job, and you get to travel a lot.
You're Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Paranormal's Jack Kerouac.
And I go, yeah, I live out of hotel rooms for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and it's fun to a point, but Stan's the same way. And when he was doing his speaking tours, he would do, you know, try and string 12, 13, 14 dates to maximize his earning potential and minimize his costs. And, it's a grind to be bouncing from city to city to city every day.
Yeah. Well, here's something that he might not want to hear, but I get the impression when you say he puts the emphasis on the ET and not the H, that he gets more attention and speaking dates with putting the emphasis on the ET. And ipso facto, you know, that is why he believes it. It's a self-fulfilling. You see what I'm getting at?
I do.
Not just him, a lot of people.
No, I do. And the one thing I respect about Stan is the charge has been labeled at him over the years that he's a huckster in the Peter Jennings documentary, which I really liked. I really liked the Peter Jennings film, but when they called him when they called him a Roswell promoter.
Oh, that was deplorable. I hated that moment.
They probably shouldn't have used that term.
What did they call him?
A Roswell promoter. And yet he is.
I mean,
that's what he is, but it doesn't have to be a pejorative term. They took it that way, and I think maybe the documentary meant it that way. But it does. He goes out and he promotes Roswell because he believes in Roswell. I've talked to Stan enough, I've read enough of his old writings to see that in the 60s, he was more skeptical, what I would call skeptical. He sat on the fence.
Yeah.
And at some point,
he was pulling a Hynek, sort of.
At some point before Roswell, before he got into Roswell, he made the leap. As did some very other intelligent people, including Dr. James McDonald, who was a firm proponent of the ETH. Bruce McAbee's another one. You know, these are bright guys, and they've made that leap based on the evidence, and I haven't. So, but I don't think Stan does what he does because, you know, he figures it's going to play to the crowd. I think the crowd comes to him, but that's largely irrelevant to him. I think he does. He truly, really believes that, you know, alien spacecraft are landing or flying above Earth and crashing on Earth and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And I can respect that. I just disagree.
Right. As the be-all, end-all theory. Because there's so many different ways of looking at it, and unfortunately none of them answer all the questions.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the ETH doesn't, and the interdimensional thing doesn't, and the crypto,
crypto-terrestrial, yeah.
Terrestrials doesn't.
Thanks, Paul.
Sorry? Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, maybe one of them does. Well, you can look at it, and the problem is everybody pigeonholes themselves into a certain theory. Certain people are ETH guys. Other people who follow Jacques Vallée say the extra-dimensional hypothesis.
Yeah.
There are people out there who say it's time travelers. And there are people who say, look, it's all mundane, you know, it's plasma, it's ball lightning, it's
but also these aren't necessarily mutually exclusive.
Absolutely.
You can have different combinations.
Exactly, exactly.
And I've had this conversation with Stan, and I said, you know, Stan, what about the extra-dimensional?
Is a bad word.
Huh?
Is a bad word.
No. I asked him about the extra-dimensional hypothesis. I said, what about
it? No, not with Stan. I mean, just about what we're talking about.
Oh, yes, 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 quite. And Stan said, look, I'm not against the extra-dimensional hypothesis. Maybe these aliens are coming here from another dimension. I don't know, but all I know
think
is they're aliens.
I had that same talk with him.
Yeah. He's open to different possibilities. He's open to time travel as a concept, but he's firmly rooted in the 50s and 60s. I mean, his lecture is still flying saucers are real. And that's where he's rooted, and it's, in a way, and I mean this in the kindest way, it's actually quite charming.
Yeah, because he still says flying saucers.
Yeah, and he doesn't apologize for it, and that's what he believes.
Actually, I like that about
him. Yeah, and I go for it.
Yeah.
you know, and a guy like me comes along, and I say UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, is the term we should be using. I don't even like UFO. And Stan just looks at me and he goes, well, you know, don't be an apologist, ufologist. And I say, well, I'm not an apologist, and I'm not a ufologist. neither of those terms. I'm a U-apologist, which creates a whole different sort of...
Yeah. Apologist.
Yeah, yeah. But, Stan's a great guy, and he's done a lot of good work, and I have nothing but the utmost respect for him, even as we... And that's what should be, and unfortunately is all too often not the case, in the study of UFOs. You can disagree with somebody, in fact vehemently, but do it politely.
Yeah.
And, you know, Stan wrote a column in the MUFON Journal last May ripping me about MJ-12, and I responded on my blog riffing him. Not personally, but just, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But then, you know, you call him up 2 days later and go, hey, how's Aunt Marilyn? How are things going? Blah, blah, blah. And I'd like to think that's not just because we're related. I'd like to think that everybody could do that.
There's anybody that I keep any kind of contact with, in ufology or anything, I think it's the height of civilized behavior to be able to, you know, practically claw at each other in an argument and then have a beer afterwards and do whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just opinions.
Look, I went after Redfern as much as anybody else on his Body Snatchers book. I had specific criticisms about areas that I knew, namely the Nuremberg trials and some of the history that he was talking about that he just plain got wrong.
Uh-huh.
Nick didn't mind. He said, great. I'm not wedded to the theory. I put it out there. Let's have the discussion. Fine.
Yeah, he said the same thing when I interviewed him on here about the book. He was just, you know, this is what I've found. If you disagree with it, show me why.
Yeah.
And if I'm wrong, I'll say, hey, that part was wrong.
There are those people in ufology. You know, Nick's one of them. Carl Flock is another. Kevin Randall's another. There are good people you can disagree with, and at the end of the day, walk away and have a beer or whatever. Then there are the others. Unfortunately, as the years go along, there are far too many of the others.
Well, it's the same as anything else, the way everything else is going.
Yeah.
You got to be this or that. And if you're not for us, you're against us kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then that's it. It's no gray, pun intended or not, areas anymore.
Yeah, but, you know, like, Max should be on the radio. Max should have his own show, frankly. But
well, why doesn't he? I've got a show. What the hell?
Actually, I'm thinking about doing some sort of podcast.
Yeah, you should.
It's not out of the realm of possibility.
Tim Vinall does that from his house, and I get his podcast all the time. He's talked to Stan and everybody.
Richard Dolan, Alfred Weber. He did a thing on exopolitics with Weber, which was amusing.
Who's Weber?
Alfred Weber. He's Canada's leading exopolitician, or whatever they call themselves.
Oh, okay.
Lives out in the West Coast, I think, in Vancouver. He's got a jade, you know, he's a lawyer by training, and seems to be a pretty bright guy, except for the fact that he's into exopolitics. So, but otherwise, he's quite bright.
What about this exo? You know, for people that don't know what the hell this is, maybe we should describe to them this. I was about to say this circus, but that's ad hominem. But you know what? I think we can be in this case. What is this exopolitics thing? And I know what it is because I've had that head to head with Michael Sala.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny? It got very heated, but he never got personal about it.
You know what? And I go, ugh, like that. And it's not personal for me either. I'm sure Michael Sala is a very nice fellow. And when he corresponds with you, say, on UFO updates or something, it's always very pleasant. And yet, Saul is not quite as nice as he seems to be because he recently used a very loaded term, and he knows exactly what it means to the people who are looking at it, debunker. And he applied that term to Stan Friedman, Kevin Randall, and Brad Sparks. Now, I'm sorry, but you certainly can't apply the term debunker to Stan Friedman.
Right.
You probably can't apply it to Kevin Randall, at least not in that sort of broad general thing. And I wouldn't apply it to Brad either. They're skeptics on certain things, especially
right.
Corso, Philip Corso.
Right.
But to see him use that term indicates to me that he's not quite as nice and cuddly and friendly as sometimes he would lead us to believe, and he has pretty sharp elbows like everybody else.
Yeah, but what the hell is exopolitics anyway, for those listening?
Matt, I'll give my answer first, then Matt can give his. It's contacteeism updated for the 21st century. That's it.
I was actually going to say that and cite Paul as my source for that, but I think he's very, very right. It has its roots in the contactee thing, but I think it's also, it lends itself to disinformation in a very, very, scary way.
Yeah, but how? See, we've described
what you think it is,
but not what it represents itself as.
It hinges very, very, in a big way on hidden technology, and if we could only free up this extraterrestrial technology, back engineered whatever, then the world will be a quasi utopia.
Yeah.
We're getting there. Yeah, it's just if we only get the government to disclose what it knows, the government knows everything. It's keeping the planet in the dark, and it's a very binary, extremely simplistic way of looking at it. And I mean, you can't prove a negative. You can't say, well, maybe it's. And I think elements of it are. I'm interested in Roswell, for example.
Right.
And if some sort of high tech craft did indeed crash, the Corso scenario. Although I don't buy Corso's account, what he describes seeding industry with alien technology is something that would probably
sounds wonderful,
happen.
And there's zero proof for it except for what he said.
Right, and
or Bob and Ryan would ever they were trying to actually go and find out everything in Corso's book and find out what the flow chart was for those inventions.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if they ever got very far with that. You know, where did transistors come? What did Kevlar come from? What did fiber optics come from? And at least three or four of those I've looked into a little bit, and there's no, missing link anywhere.
Right.
It's always, fiber optics. Oh, some guy at Corning pulled a glass fiber out and then discovered it had these strange properties
right. In
1950, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And, if you were with Corso, you said, he wouldn't have known to pull that glass fiber out unless he'd been seated. It's like, you pull a piece of melted glass and it does that. It makes these little thin things that look like hairs.
Mm.
It was only a matter of time, but.
Corso was crap, and that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to say about Philip Corso in the day after
Roswell.
But why
did he write that then?
There's any one of a number of reasons, not the least of which could be profit, because I know people say he didn't make much money from the book. I find that hard to believe because it's one of the few books that actually sold. And you can still get it in bookstores. You go to the UFO section.
Yeah, it's
ever
still
dwindling.
I bought it in hardback. I wanted to read this.
I read it too.
Yeah, I went out and immediately purchased it.
But if you look at Corso's background as well in the military, it might be some sort of, might have been some form of continuing disinformation or intelligence operation. Who knows?
Or
that's
an ego
possible.
Trip. A huge ego trip.
Or a huge ego trip.
He's the most important person of the 21st century, the 20th century by far, if even a fraction of what he says is true. He saved the planet.
And people have trouble understanding that people can be motivated by all of those things, any one of them. They have trouble understanding. I've talked to them, the Corso supporters, that, oh, he'd never do it for money, or he'd never do it just so he could seem important. And of course people do things for that.
Well, the whole Strom Thurmond thing, the introduction to the original edition, Strom Thurmond was not told. He was told that it was a different book. And he didn't even say
anything about the subject of the book, which should have given you a clue. All he did was say, this guy's a straight shooter, and I've known him for a long time, and he was a good right-wing fascist working for MacArthur, etc.
Right.
The clue is, for me, that there's no index in the book. There's no footnotes. I mean, obviously you might not want a footnote, top secret Super MJ-12 report 27 or something, because you don't have it, but you can at least, you know, create a book that had the veneer of an academic study, even in that context.
Right,
and he didn't.
Right.
It's just basically him throwing stuff at the wall and hoping some of it stick. And it did, because people start showing up at his house. He's a big guy all of a sudden again within a very small pond. I think Paul Hellyer's doing the same thing in Canada, although for different reasons. But if you look
you can
at all,
explain who that is.
Former Minister of Defense, the Canadian Minister of Defense in the late 60s under Pearson, who decided it would be a good idea to unify Canada's military, and it was, and then he proceeded to do it in all the wrong ways. And you know, if you don't believe me, ask any old sailor who was put in a green uniform that you know whether or not the unification was brought off properly. But the point is, with all of these people, and Max sort of touched on it, some of the links. What I find fascinating is this is linked very specifically to the peace and love movement, as I like to call it, the anti-ballistic missile movement, you name it, they are trying to get into it. So if you look at some of the exopolitics blogs or websites, they have the same sort of thing that the contactees were talking about in the 50s. You know, the aliens are here to save us from nuclear war, save us from ourselves. Well, same thing again. The anti-ballistic missile system, whether you agree with it or not, you know, it's not directed at aliens, I'm sorry. It's directed at something else, things down here on this planet. But if you look at how intelligence operations are run, and I think there's an awful lot of people in the UFO field that don't really understand how these things run sometimes.
Well, from my experience, they don't want to understand.
Exactly. And an awful lot of stuff, and Nick makes this point in his book, that has to do with UFOs, had nothing to do with UFOs. They would be intelligence operations that had other purposes, and they used UFOs to achieve those purposes. If you want to make people, say, in Canada, who are against the ballistic missile program, a sizable proportion of the Canadian populace, tie them to UFOs, and not just UFOs, tie them to the most radical group of UFO people who believe there's 37 alien races on the planet, there's been 74 crash flying saucers, you know, the American government has a top secret deal, and President Bush is building bases on the moon right now. Tie them to that.
I never really thought about all that as connected with exopolitics. I wanted you to expand on it. But it makes things seem a lot more exciting and wonderful now, even though it's stupid. It makes me feel like, oh, this is like the 50s again, the thing that I missed, my favorite period of ufology.
All things new are old. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So old is new, like they said in the Hitchcock film. The one where not Kirk Douglas, but
Citizen Kane.
No, I'm just kidding. Touch of Evil, I think.
Yeah,
the one that takes place in Mexico.
Touch of Evil is not a Hitchcock film. See, now you...
That's right.
It's Orson Welles.
It's Orson Welles. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
I poisoned your mind with the Citizen Kane. See, mind control.
Yeah.
There you go. M.K. Polkra.
Yeah. So, yeah, exopolitics is so old it's new.
Yeah, basically. People need to look at some of the... look at Stephen Greer, who just came up to Canada. He's brought up by some very well-meaning guys, Victor Vigiani and Mike Bird, nice, you know, decent guys in Toronto. They mean well, but I don't think they really see the big picture, so they bring Stephen Greer up to link him with Paul
Hellyer. They don't know who they're messing with.
Yeah, and they say, look, we want to call for the equivalent of congressional hearings in Canada, Senate parliamentary hearings on the UFO problem, and full disclosure, which is another... topic we can talk about a bit later, the term disclosure.
Yeah.
But if you're bringing Greer up, all the baggage the guy carries with him, you know, you only get one shot to make a serious call for the government to look seriously into the UFO problem.
Yeah, we see how well he did down here.
Exactly. And as Dick Hall would be the first to tell you, and then there's a whole lineup of people afterwards who would tell you the same thing, there was some movement to try and get members of Congress to take it seriously and at least look at it. And maybe at a subcommittee level, you know, maybe not grand congressional hearings, but at least start to look at it, because they've looked at other things.
It, you know what? It happens about every 10 years or so, 10 or 15 years. It happened in the 70s.
Yeah.
I think it might have happened in the 80s.
We're going to be waiting another 10 years now.
Yeah. But when it does, Stephen Greer pops up. And am I saying Stephen Greer's working for the government? No. Am I saying that's something that people should consider? Yes. You know, who knows what Dr.
Or the
Greer's
third possibility, which is somebody's back there pulling the strings or poking him.
Absolutely. And he could be sort of an unwilling dupe, which is what I think Wilbert Smith was back in the 50s. For different reasons, it had nothing to do with UFOs. So, you know, like you say, all things new or old.
We can talk about that, too.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm doing my conference lecture on in the UK.
Right.
But Mac needs some mic time. Max getting antsy.
No. I was just going to say, I think Greer is more than happy to pull his own strings and push his own buttons. What Paul was talking about is totally applicable, but I don't even think he even need to invoke the government backing or disinformation.
Yeah. But things get that ridiculous, you start to wonder, though.
Oh, yeah. It's what we're living in a century where it's so hard to satirize because everything is so over the top anyway.
Remember that thing in The Simpsons where that's somebody goes up to Bart and says, "Are you joking or are you serious?" And he says, "You know, I don't know anymore."
that's the 21st century.
Yeah.
At least the early 21st century.
There are good witnesses. That's what a lot of people forget. In Greer's Disclosure Project, there were good witnesses.
I'm going
to be talking to a few of them for this film on the top 10 cases.
Witnesses meaning people in the military who had experience with something...
Something that was different. Something that couldn't be explained.
Right.
There were good people there. The problem is, you know, you put the good people in with Dr. Greer and a lot of crazy people. And I have no problem using the term crazy. In this context, there were people in there that just, you know, have no business being next to a guy like Robert Salas from the Malmstrom Air Force Base case.
Right, right.
They shouldn't be linked together in any way, shape, or form. But if you can link Salas from a very good case, the Malmstrom case, with somebody who's not a good witness, then suddenly Salas seems a bit kooky. And people tend to throw all of them out. And
this is classic stuff. But it's also classic, you know, bad organization, you know. So you could take it either way or both.
Sure.
I mean, the other thing is that things will fall, you know, maybe somebody has decided, we leave Greer alone, and he's going to fall on his own, so we don't even have to do anything about it.
If it's a one-off, then yeah, but if you look and you say, is there more than just Dr. Greer, is there a pattern of behavior from a group of individuals that seems to be the same sort of pattern over and over again, then you at least have to countenance the idea that there might be more here than just a bunch of guys trying to make money, or trying to stroke their ego, or whatever it is you might think their motivation is, or just being plain old naive. There might be something else here, and whether they're being manipulated or whether they're actually part of the manipulation is an entirely different question. And that's something your book started to raise, and Nick's books, you know, that's the kind of stuff that ufology needs to come to grips with, rather than just saying, well, Greer's nuts and we'll ignore him. Well, take a look at him, see what's happening, and try and figure out if there is something bigger going here.
Yeah, well, that's part of the, you know, it's part of the positive, negative, is or isn't, let's ignore it, let's pay total attention to it, way that a lot of people operate.
The funny thing is, you know, you'll hear people in ufology say the media is in link with the CIA and the government, and they're all, you know, every documentary that comes out has an agenda, blah, blah, blah. And yet they'll never think about that in
the
context.
There's been some good, very good documentaries.
Stanton T. Friedman is real.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, no, of course there have. But they won't sort of apply that same sort of analysis to people within their own field. And I think that's a mistake.
Fortunately, oh, no, you caught me reading an email. Sorry.
There you go. You're reading an email. Uh-oh.
And
for anyone, I've just pissed off, you know, the entire ETH community. So sorry.
Well, the extraterrestrial hypothesis is so infectious and so delicious that it's...
That's a great quote.
It exerts a very powerful appeal. I mean, the whole space alien, I mean, everyone has grown up with it, and it's just... It's everywhere. We're inundated with it, and a lot of people are trained not to question it. I'm not saying purposefully trained, but just our culture. We invest very little time in rational discussion about weird things. Weird things are relegated to this kind of this twilight zone that we don't.
If they weren't, they wouldn't be weird, would they?
Exactly. Right. I like the idea of mainstreaming the weird. I don't like having to, you know.
I do too. What would be weird then, you know?
People
living in the suburbs with jobs they hate?
I think that's weird. I think that's extraordinarily weird, distressingly weird. That's the stuff that's weird to me. Yeah, I don't like
these
the fact that UFOs are real. That UFOs are weird.
But Mac, you live in the suburbs.
I know, and I don't like it.
Yeah,
I'm working on that situation right now.
Yeah, you know, I remember I met John Shirley. I'm sure you know who he is.
In fact, when he came down here, I wanted to.
I interviewed him once on my show because we used to hang out, and then he moved up back up north.
I think the world of John Shirley. He's a great, great writer and a great guy. We've been in email correspondence. And I sent him an email, and I said it's coming to California. I had no idea where he lived down here. I'm reading his book Crawlers right now, actually.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't know where he was going to be, and I was going to. If he was like an hour away or something, that maybe
he's in the Bay Area.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
maybe we could get coffee or something. But I'll meet him someday probably.
And I forgot what I was going to say about him. He
Silicon Embrace, great, great book. You can learn a lot from that as far as the whole disclosure
thing.
And it's a very little known book, unfortunately. But you follow.
Plus, I'm thanked in the front of the book, which I thought was really cool.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because he started reading when I was publishing my magazine. He started reading that. And I saw him at a MUFON conference because he was interested in it at the time. He finally got disgusted with the UFO subject and dropped out of it.
And I don't blame him. but that's a good book. And Crawlers, too, has some very good UFO references. And just about how people take the whole Roswell myth, though, something so extravagantly weird, and it's almost common. The X-Files, you know, helped make it just this... Well, yeah, the Roswell crash, an alien spacecraft crashed in New Mexico in 1947, and the government covered it up. Very casual. You know, that's just people accept that, you know, on a very non-committal basis.
It's funny, Mac.
Well, it's fun on top of that. I mean, it's fun to think that actually happened.
It is fun. It is fun. And I catch myself because sometimes I find myself thinking, you know, why not? You know, this could, and I'm still agnostic on it, but yeah, you have to catch yourself because of this weird magnetic allure of the extraterrestrial hypothesis or the interdimensional hypothesis, whatever you want to call it.
Or soon, the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis.
Or the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis.
Which will sweep the world.
Which is weirder than them all, probably, but maybe closer to the truth. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I've been interested recently. Out at the Integratron for many years, I've been thinking, somebody's got to put up a marker here, a historical marker, just to say what went on here in the 1950s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
And the E. Clampus Vitus people put one up. It's huge. It's like 6 feet tall and has brass on the front with about 400 words on it describing George Van Tassel, what the Integratron was. But they're a very strange group. It's a secret society made up of people who... couldn't get in a secret society, like a bunch of miners in California. But their one of their hallmark, you know, their guiding phrases is "I believe it because it is absurd," which they actually took from a Christian saint who decided that the miracles in the Bible and things like I can't remember who it was were more true because they made so little sense.
That's kind of
if you can get your mind around that.
It's kind of like Ryan Wood's claim that hoax documents that the ones that have blatant flaws in them, that means they're real because the real hoaxes are always perfect.
Yeah,
and it's funny. It's a funny mind game when you start thinking about it. It's very elliptical.
Exactly.
Keeps you entertained for a while.
Yeah, but on the Clampus Vitus part, it's kind of like, you know, let's accept that everything's insane and revel in that and find some truth and spiritual sustenance in that.
Well, I could definitely sympathize with accepting that everything is insane. I like that part.
I think the important thing to note for your listeners is that the ETH hypothesis is going back to being a hypothesis for most people. And I think that's a balancing out. I truly believe that at least within the small...
How do you get that feeling, though?
The small core group, there'll always be the people, and most of them are a bit older now. But it's like the lion in winter.
You're going ahead further in my script here. Go right ahead.
No. Sorry.
I knew we'd get to all this stuff. It's fine.
It's like the lion in winter. You've got these young guys, and I can list them, you know. And by young, I mean probably under 45 or, you know, so to speak.
Yeah.
Mac, you, Nick Redfern, William Wise, who runs the Project Blue Book Archive.
Oh, really? Okay.
And is a very bright, youngish guy. I mean, and you can go down the list. These are the futures of whatever the future of whatever ufology is. And I think all of these people are agnostics to one degree or another.
Note that Paul excludes himself from that list. I think that's interesting.
I'm just a filmmaker. But I think most of these people are agnostic. And Mac and I were discussing this in the car in a religious connotation today, but it applies to ufology too. I don't see how you can be an atheist on UFOs and just, you know, pull a class and say they don't exist, there's no such thing.
Yeah.
I don't see how you can be a believer, because I don't believe the evidence supports their existence as either a structured craft from another planet or time travelers, whatever. I think
it does sometimes.
I think you have to be an agnostic and say, the evidence indicates there's something anomalous going on in the skies above us.
Right.
What that is.
Well, I think the term UFO does a good job. It's an unidentified. I know you have issues with the term UFO because it's got some loaded semantic connotations, I suppose, but I like it. But people forget what it means. People think UFO means alien spaceship, and I get very exasperated with those people.
Right, exactly. They'll say, do you believe in UFOs? And I said, well, there's two problems there. You're saying UFO, and more importantly, you're saying belief.
Right.
But, yeah, exactly. You know, the two very loaded terms.
But as soon as you put flying object in, and this is why I prefer unidentified aerial phenomena, which could be a structured alien spacecraft, or it could be ball lightning and plasma. And some UFO sightings are plasma. Not all UFO sightings, as the Ministry of Defense report out of the UK a couple of weeks ago seemed to indicate. But there's probably some small percentage of sightings that are caused by plasma, by other atmospheric phenomena that maybe we don't even understand yet.
Don't even know if it's plasma yet.
Well, yeah.
The plasmic explanations are actually, I think many of them are plausible, but I think that...
Which one?
The Coke.
Here you go. More caffeine for Paul.
Thank you.
But I think some of the electromagnetic explanations are, when you start looking at them in depth, they're actually quite stranger. And I'm not saying they're not valid explanations, because I think they are, but they're as far as something generated by tectonic stress scrambling your brain waves and making you hallucinate an abduction.
Right.
I think that's it's a good test for Occam's razor. What's stranger, the an actual ET spacecraft doing this, or your mind manufacturing this event? Because of some onslaught of microwave radiation or something. It's interesting.
But, people will make the mistake listening to this or listening to the conversation or thinking about it, that like they did with the release of that, what's it called?
Condyne report.
It's so funny. Condyne.
It is. Yeah.
A
random generated name, apparently. So.
Oh, of course.
There you go.
Next is going to be the condom report.
Now that one I'd read.
Yeah, I think I have read that one.
Yeah.
They're going to make the mistake that what we're talking about here and what that Condyne report was that it's plasma and that's it.
Yeah.
But that's not what the report was. I mean, it's so big and so all-encompassing. And people that are on the UFO updates list still haven't gotten through it, 3 months later, whatever it is, because it's so goddamn big.
My understanding is that it was written by one person who basically didn't do any field research, just basically kind of theorizing like a blogger.
Right.
But as usual, some of the ETH guys came out and immediately attacked it. And without reading it, like they didn't read your book or Nick's book or a lot of other things,
right?
Because they read a summary, or because the four guys that dug it out, Anthony, Clark, Roberts, and Joe McMonagall, are guys that they don't like. They're UK guys, and they see them as
Joe McGonagall.
Or McGonagall, right.
McGonagall's the other dude.
Yeah, yeah.
He's
the remote viewer, sorry.
I like him.
They see them as being debunkers, but they didn't write the report. They're just the guys that got it released through Freedom of Information.
Right, right. And they're throwing stones at them.
Yeah. And that's the kind of infighting that takes place in ufology. And I wrote it in my blog. I said, look, let's just step back, wait for the full report to come out, read it. But this is a PR problem. Instead of guys getting up and going, bad, 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 what you should do, and it was William Wise who, on a comment on my blog, first suggested this to me, and I printed it as a full column,
right?
Embrace this and say, look, we have a major Western government, probably the number two military power in the Western alliance, saying UFOs or UAPs are real. And here's what we think we are. Ignore that part, but just say they admit they're real, that they've studied it for 4 years. They took it seriously.
And they studied it for a lot longer before that, and they're using their own data from going back, 50 years or so to come to these conclusions.
The same phenomenon happened when the Kometa report came out.
Right.
People criticized it. What they should have done is said, look, a major Western government has taken UFOs seriously in the modern era, and they continue to do so because they've gone back and restructured the French space agency, CNES, has restructured their committee and are again looking into apparently UFO reports.
Well, there were no references to EBEs in the report and turned people off.
Yeah, well, if they don't see that they're little alien guys from Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, then they think it must be a debunking effort or not worthwhile. And that's where I have a fundamental disagreement with them. I think it, and then you ask, why does SETI get a ton of money? Because Stan says SETI, silly effort to investigate bad science. I don't necessarily agree. But, you know, SETI is great at raising money, at being in the forefront of public awareness, of having real scientists attached to the project, whether you think they're right or wrong. These are good scientists. And actually getting in front of Congress. And I put something up on my blog from a congressional hearing in 2001, the science subcommittee, where they brought the SETI guys in and said, well, look, here's a bunch of questions on life out there.
Yes, I did. And it was you put in that part where the senator, whoever it was, didn't even let the guy speak.
Well, he was trying to get an answer. And you know,
he was trying to pigeonhole an answer. It's
true.
Just, yeah.
But the scientists were as slippery as eels, you know, not wanting this. All he wanted, I can't remember, what is the percentage?
I want to know the percentage of intelligent civilizations in the universe right now.
Well, no, he was asking, what is the chance that there's intelligent life out there? And every scientist is like, and finally one guy... just said, and it's...
Nobody mentioned that in that either.
I know.
They didn't use Drake
equation. I can't remember which scientist it was, though, but he just... I can picture him looking up at the congressman and saying, 50-50. I just thought...
Okay, are you happy? Here's your bone.
There
now,
you go,
now, 50-50. Let's go on.
51-49. Yeah. So, you know, but why not? Why aren't ufologists in front of Congress?
It's interesting because SETI, at one point, I think maybe just a year or two ago, maybe it still is, was number one or number two in the country as far as nonprofit institutions where the most money went to its senior administrators.
Wow.
Jill Tarter and Seth Shostak. So, yeah, it's extraordinarily successful, and they're making money, too. And I love this whole idea that we have alien experts right here on Earth. And definitely, they're qualified scientists, and I'm not begrudging them that, but I don't like the self-appointed alien expert mentality that that's trotted out routinely in documentaries like the Peter Jennings Show. As good as it was, and like Paul, I liked it. I thought the first half was quite good.
Yeah, the first half was much better than the second half.
Yeah, it's much better.
But that's the problem. The first half.
That's funny. That's where you and a lot of ufologists agree.
Well, yeah. And I do with many of them about many things. The first half was great. The second half got into the two things that have completely undermined ufology.
Yeah,
alien
abductions
and Roswell, and what I've called Roswellism, which is, you know, Roswell writ large. And when you see the guys like the exopoliticians, the exopolitics guys come up, I've been known to call them Stan Friedman's bastard children because... You know, and I could call them Kevin Randall's bastard children or whatever, because they take the, if you believe aliens
Bill
are here.
Bill Moore, for that matter.
Well, or Bill, anybody who believes the extraterrestrial hypothesis, as they do, aliens
are
here.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, Bill doesn't really totally believe that.
It's not that far a leap to move beyond that, once you've made that leap, to make another leap and say, well, okay, maybe, you know, we're in contact with them and blah, blah, blah. So sometimes the criticisms leveled by, at the exopolitics types, even though I agree with them, coming from the ETH supporters, always get a little chuckle out of me. But I agree with Stan and Brad, and well, Brad's not an ETH guy, sorry. Stan and Kevin and others, you know, exopolitics takes what they do and just throws it out the window. Because whatever else you can say about Stan and Kevin and their beliefs and what they support, they look at evidence and they vet witnesses, and guys like Michael Salah just don't. they don't have a vetting process.
Well, you know what he actually, before we go to a break, what he actually said to me in that exchange, and where I just said, forget it. So he said, the reason people have problems with my approach is because it doesn't rely on witness testimony or documentation. I was like, what? What kind of a method is that? I said, you know what, that's fine, but don't ask anybody to listen to you. Don't ask anybody besides people who already agree with you to listen to you. Yeah. That means you're never going to get anywhere. Sorry. You know, and then he said, okay, fine, you know, you can have your opinion. And then that was it. So it was insane. I read on Mac's blog that he's unabashedly into 80s pop music.
Me too.
Yeah?
I made a career out of playing 80s pop music.
Is there something you want to hear? I actually racked up Nothing to Fear by Oingo Boingo, which used to be one of my favorite bands. You hate them, don't you?
You don't have any Morrissey?
Don't like Morrissey at all.
How about Depeche Mode? Do you got any Depeche Mode? Hey, how about The Cure?
I have The Cure.
The Cure.
I've probably got two or three Cure songs.
What 80s music were you guys listening to? The Icicle Works?
Don't
Do we have any Icicle Works?
No.
Big Country?
I remember that band. I did not like them at all.
What did they do?
That big country song.
You guys were in some parallel dimension 80s, apparently.
I didn't discover 80s music until the 90s.
How old are you?
30.
Oh, okay. That's what's going on here. Okay, Paul and I are about the same age, probably about 10 years older.
Yeah. We lived the 80s.
The future of ufology.
Let's see. Here we go. The Cure. There's got to be at least two on here. They're all off the same album. Boys Don't Cry, Jumping Someone Else's Train, and Killing an Arab.
Nice.
You know what? That's one of my favorites.
Nice Albert Camus homage there.
Exactly. You know what's funny? They had to put an explanation on the re-release album cover so they weren't saying anything bad about Arab.
Right.
Because people
don't read. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay.
They'll be the death of us.
Can we get some Madonna after this?
Don't have any of that. I have Japanese women singing Madonna songs with a banjo.
There's a difference.
Sorry. The difference is I like it.
Oh, well, there you go. I want some Hoagy Carmichael before we go too.
Okay, I got that.